this on the same basis, that if we're given some documentation that there's a particular kind of product or substance that has had a latency period of longer than 8 years, that we should then pass legislation changing the statute of limitations for that substance, instead of coming up ahead of time with this general language that's going to create, in my opinion, a lot of litigation?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, it's a good point, but I guess I would point to the fact that other states have already recognized that the body of potential substances or potential harm is so broad that I could perceive, for example, this committee spending several sessions looking at a variety of specific substances. Let me give you one example. There's a substance used in many paints called isocyanates. In the past, we knew they were dangerous, but we weren't sure of their latent danger until something happened in a place called Bhopal, India, which you may have heard of, where several thousand people were killed in an acute manner. Well, here in Oregon, there are several companies where individuals work with those substances and are now, after a period of 8 or 10 years, developing very severe central nervous disorders. I would think as a public policy issue to come back each time one particular substance out of the more than 50,000 toxic chemicals that are currently in use in this country, coming back each time with a case may serve those people who are affected after the law. What happens now is people that are finding out about this after the 8 years, we're essentially saying the public policy of Oregon is, sorry, too late. And I don't think that's basically fair.
Yeah, Representative Mannix, yes, go ahead.
From a cost-benefit analysis, though, aren't we creating disincentives to experimentation, to inventiveness, to ingenuity in terms of products, when people will also have to try to predict what is the effect going to be 8 years down the pike today with my new product? I've got to have an idea what is going to happen 8 years from now in order to figure out what my risk is.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, once again, I'd go back to the fact that we are in the minority of states that don't have this type of statute. If that's happening, it's not going to happen because we are extending the same rights that many other people throughout the country already enjoy to Oregonians. I don't believe that with our standard, when we look at percentages of the market, when you compare sales across the country, I think Oregon usually accounts for somewhere between 1% and 2% of the market. And I suppose the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, for example, could argue that that's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I don't see that as being the case.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Baum?
How many states are there that have this similar law?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, I don't know the exact number. I'd have to get back to you on it. I know that.
You know what California does?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, I'm not sure.
Well, I would lock more credibility to your testimony if I had specifics. It would be nice if we had possibly some indications of what the statute said in relation to their exact language.
Sure.
I mean, I appreciate the statements, but if you throw North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri into the deal and left off California and New York, then the majority of America doesn't enjoy this bill. So if you could be more specific, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, I will get you that, and I've worked in New York in the past, and I know that New York is one of the areas that has this.
Thank you, Mr. Novick. Are there further questions? Thank you. That concludes the public hearing on House Bill 2423. And we'll now proceed to House Bill 2426, Mike Crew. I'm sorry, if Mike, your name is first here, but again, our policy is to call the sponsor, and Art Johnson is the sponsor on House Bill 2426, so representing the sponsor. You're next, Mike.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Johnson, Arthur C. Johnson. I'm a lawyer in Eugene. I've been practicing law in Eugene, representing individuals in the courts of the state for a little over 35 years. In my experience as a lawyer, I have been president of the Oregon State Bar. I'm currently the president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. At the beginning, I signed up to speak on 2426 Madam Chairman, two questions, I think, very good questions, have been asked about the last measure discussed, 21-23, and if I could first comment in response to those, I think I'd appreciate that permission.
Go ahead.
All right. I think two questions appropriately were asked is, one, would the change in that legislation be a disincentive to development of new and experimental drugs? I think that's a real serious question. I can say in the experience that I have had, normally when people are dealing with new and experimental drugs and take them, there is a special program for it, and commonly they sign a waiver for that, and there's no liability problem. For the normally there would not be liability unless there was negligence in any event. But in the cases I've known of with experimental drugs, waiver's been signed, and there would not be a problem or any inhibition. I think the manufacturers and people working in that field took care of the problem in that rather efficient way. Another question I think was appropriately asked was about when a particular problem like the Dock and Shield comes along or asbestosis, wouldn't it be more appropriate for the victims to come before the legislature and ask for a specific relief at that time? In those cases, there were literally thousands of women that suffered, hundreds of thousands of women that suffered from the Dock and Shield, and many more than that suffered from asbestosis. So there's a large group of people who could become organized and could come to the legislature and speak and get what I think was appropriate relief, and the legislature granted it. In many cases, however, you do not have that large body of individuals. I'll mention just one case. You probably read in the news during the last year, a worker in the woods in Oregon who was caused to spray herbicides manufactured by Dow was stricken with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer that affects the system, the glands. That case, it happened after he became ill. He moved to Arkansas, right on the border of Texas, saw a lawyer there, and the lawyer there, Scott Baldwin, filed a case for him, and that originally Oregon citizen who was injured here in Oregon, died of that disease, but his family made a recovery against Dow Chemical for the cancer that was caused by that herbicide. That same case could not have been prosecuted in Oregon. And by the same token, it was only one individual, that individual or three or four workers in the woods who came in with that rather uncommon disease, but a disease that is clearly linked by studies both in Sweden and in this country, in Kansas and Nebraska studies, to the use of 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D. Those cases couldn't be prosecuted in Oregon, and if only a few of those cases came before the legislature, I think it'd be difficult to have the resources to lobby for a change in the law just for exception of those one or two people. So I wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Now to...
The reason I came today is to speak to you about 2426. This would adopt for Oregon the rule of pure comparative negligence. In thinking about the bill, I called a number of attorneys about the state in the last few days and asked them about their experience with current law. I found that a number of them had had the experience where they had tried a case where a claimant they thought was worthy and had a valid case was found to be slightly more negligent than the other side. That is, they were found to be 51-49 or 55-45 or 60-40, and so they lost. Their medical bills in some cases remained unpaid. Their wage loss remained unrecovered because if they were a little more negligent than the defendant, they lost entirely. This bill would change that rule, but it doesn't change the sense of individual responsibility. That is, if a person is negligent, whether it's a defendant or a plaintiff, they're responsible for that negligence. Respective, if it's a plaintiff, the claim is to be reduced or diminished by the proportion of fault or negligence of that individual person. This concept is really a very old concept in Oregon. We adopted it in the Employers Liability Act in about 1905, thereabouts in Oregon. It's in the Federal Employers Liability Act. It's in the maritime field, in the Jones Act, and in maritime law generally from sort of the beginning of the history of maritime law. And we find, if we look in adjoining states, both Washington and California, according to the information I have, do have pure comparative fault, pure comparative negligence. And it seems to work well there. I have handled cases in both of those states. There was no problem. The question has been suggested, well, somebody is just 5% at fault and the lawyer's going to file that claim. I suggest normally that isn't the experience. The lawyer is still going to screen claims, is going to file claims only that appear to have merit. He's in business too, and economically he has to file claims that have merit or he's not going to succeed. So there may be cases, ultimately, where a jury would find that someone was 95% at fault and he would recover only 5% of his damages, but I think it's rare, very rare, that a case like that would ever be filed by the attorney in the first instance. I can't imagine the attorney filing a case that he thought that was a fact situation. Rather, in the great number of cases where it's a close question of who's a little more negligent than the other, it's going to make a difference. And the medical bills and the lost wages are going to be recovered. I'd add that question's been asked, well, is this going to add greatly to the workload of the courts? I don't know how anyone can say that with great accuracy. I question it. I think some more cases will be filed. But I think also the counterpoint of that is that cases more often are going to be settled and resolved by compromise rather than by a full trial in court. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Are there questions from the committee?
No question.
Representative,
thank you for your testimony, Mr. Johnson. We hope you'll forgive me for having to leave the room temporarily. I spoke with somebody during the break, and we were talking about just the balance in the system. And one of the things I was sort of stressing, and that my concern here, and this is an area where I practice, is kind of taking a human element in a trial in which we try to give the jury the chance to make a decision as to the outcome, and breaking it into some kind of mathematics and some very odd formula, which probably doesn't make any sense to them, and then somehow trying to stuff it back out into the real world and give away a dollar amount. And I was wondering if, in your opinion, or if you'd have any position as to just possibly giving the full authority for giving a dollar amount to the jury as opposed to trying to have the jury come out with some kind of percentage, if that might be a better solution than either our present system or the proposed.
Under the Madam Chairman, Representative Calhoun, as I understand your question, you're talking about procedure, whether the jury is to find a percentage of fault or is it just find a dollar amount. This bill doesn't really answer that question because at the present time other statutes do permit a specific verdict where the jury will answer both questions, the percentage of fault of each party and the total amount of damages that the plaintiff has suffered, and the judge does the arithmetic. Under the ELA, though, which is all it comes up in an employment situation, that's Oregon Employers Liability Act, I have tried cases under that theory where the judge simply instructed the jury that they were to reduce the damages in proportion to the plaintiff's fault, if any. And our experience under those cases, I think, was very satisfactory. There are not a lot of those cases tried today. But historically, I think that system worked very well, but that isn't, we're not proposing a change to that procedure by this measure.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, I have a question. Have you experienced a jury returning 51% negligence against the plaintiff?
I have never, in my experience, in our office about a year ago, someone else tried a case where the verdict was 55-45. That's the closest we have ever.
Bar recovery?
That barred recovery.
I guess I had this feeling or concern that juries might play with the percentages, knowing that 50% is the break-off, basically might feel depending on how their heartstrings are being played, might fall on one side of the line or the other, sort of as a value judgment, and rather than really rating negligence, but as basically delivering a verdict.
Representative Edmondson, I can't say specifically. I know of the lawyers I've interviewed on the subject, a number found that there were many verdicts in the area of 40 to 60%, 55 to 45%, and the jury, of course, in those cases, instructed they should know ahead of time by the court's instructions in Oregon that means a defense verdict. And the cases these people have been concerned with are those cases where it's really a close question, and it would be better if the damages are diminished according to the amount of fault rather than a complete verdict one way or the other.
Any other questions, Mr. Johnson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Crewe.
Chairman. My name is Mike Crewe, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. I should say that I'm a defense lawyer from the city of Portland and practice primarily in the area of defense law. And I'm not quite sure what spurred this bill. The Oregon legislature got together with a number of, a committee, if you will, of defense lawyers and plaintiff's lawyers back prior to 1971, and part of that day we had contributory negligence in this state, and if the plaintiff was 1% at fault, plaintiff lost. And there was a great deal of feeling, if you will, across the lines that was a rather harsh rule, and therefore we passed comparative negligence in a modified form in 1971, and it's worked quite well for now 18 years. And I don't know why this bill came about at this time, except possibly it's a continuation from the 1987 legislature and the evolution of our tort laws. But the point is that until 1974 in the United States, contributory negligence was the majority rule. The states took a look at it, and it's been evolving since. And since that time, there are a relatively few number of states, primarily in the South, that still recognize contributory negligence as the law, if you will. And the minority position in the United States is that pure comparative is the rule. And I might add that, according to studies that we've seen, that in those states that have adopted pure comparative, the majority of those were adopted by the courts as opposed to the legislatures. When the legislatures have been given an opportunity to consider what form of fault or compensation system is going to be followed, if you will, in civil liability in the tort system, they've opted out in favor of modified comparative negligence, as Oregon did in 1971. One could only speculate as to why that happened, but I suspect that it's because of the legislature's sense of fairness, going back to their constituents and trying to explain how a person who was 90% at fault, 95% at fault, 65% at fault, whatever those figures may be, the person who was more at fault for causing the accident could be entitled to compensation. It seems to be more of an academic exercise by the courts as opposed to the legislative exercise by the jurisdictions that's considered it. It would seem, on analysis, that the innocent party, when you start comparing negligence, one party's negligence to another party's negligence, in an automobile accident, for example, that the innocent party, as between the two, becomes the victim. A perfect example I could think of is the mother who's going through an intersection, glances over her shoulder at the baby who's choking in the back seat. Somebody runs the red light, and unfortunately the person that runs the red light is catastrophically injured, and the mother with the choking child who glanced over her shoulder is going to pay for that person's injuries to a large degree if there was a large economic injury to the person. The study that we looked at, which was out of Illinois, suggests two things. Number one is that as a result of, or at least it's speculated, as a result of pure comparative negligence being passed in that state in 1980, Verdicts went up 40% in less than 1 year. The average size of verdict went up 40%. And litigation increased 6%. Now, I think it would be folly, as the study pointed out, it would be folly to say that was only because of pure comparative negligence or the passage of it. But on the other side of the coin, you can't dismiss the fact that it should have had or would have had some impact. The bottom line is that, and as Mr. Johnson pointed out, it is not in the majority of cases in this state, I don't believe, where you have a close case of 51-49 where the plaintiff loses because they're 51% at fault. You have a relatively small number of cases that where you're going to have a situation where it's going to be close. Normally it's going to be further away, like 70 or 80%. And for the few people that we're talking about in this case that are going to have the benefit of the legislation if it were passed, you're going to see insurance rates go up and you're going to see cost of litigation go up because the courts are going to be burdened, and ultimately the taxpayer is going to pay the burden of it, both in the form of premium as well as supporting the litigation system. Basically, the Oregon Medical Association opposes it, and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions of Mr. Crook? Janet Calhoun?
I was just wondering if you could give us an explanation logically, on civil lawyers, on how the cost would increase or the verdicts would change.
Presumably, what has happened in the Illinois experience is that in a catastrophic case, virtually everybody becomes a plaintiff, including the person who is most at fault if they are the one that suffered the large injury, because they will be entitled to recover, which potentially raises the verdict, the dollar value of the verdicts. I believe in if my memory is correct, in Illinois, the verdict range raised inside of 9 months or 10 months, whatever the study period was, from 38,000 to 51,000, the average size of verdicts. The study did not suggest that was specifically because of pure comparative negligence, but it suggested possibly it was a result, in part, of the passage of that legislation.
Was the figure correct that they found a 3% increase, 3 or 4%?
6% increase in litigation in the number of cases filed.
Oh, question. What would you think about a system where we just gave it all to the jury, gave them instructions and said, figure all these things, come back with a dollar. We don't want to even know how you...
Are you suggesting basically a no-fault system?
I don't practice civil.
Where you just hand the whole wad to the jury and say, you, in your sense of fairness, what should this person get? Well, I suspect to some degree that's what a jury does anyway, but I... I believe juries are capable of handling percentages. I do. We do that now in cases where we start talking about contribution. Oregon recognizes statutory contribution, and if there is a case filed which requires a jury to determine what contribution there should be between co-defendants, in fact, they will affix those percentages. I don't think it's foreign to a jury to think in terms of percentages.
I'm not exactly sure. Now, being a criminal lawyer, all the jury and they come back.
Right.
Up or down, so you don't mess around. But I don't understand exactly why we do the math for the jury, rather than just giving them the what to do and just follow that, assuming that they could do their own math. I've heard about cases where they couldn't do their own math, but came out with some awful. I don't see why we take that away from them. Is there, do you know, any justification for this much? And tell the jury. Basically, we know that you're just going to put it in dollar amounts anyway, then try to figure out the math for us. Fool us when you come back with these figures, because you're going to want to give the person what you want to give them. But we're going to make you reduce it to mathematical figures. If we can take the mathematical figures and put it back in human terms for a dollar amount. Do you know why we do that? Is there a rationale for it?
I have no idea why we do that, but in fact, you can do that in this state. In Oregon, you can submit a general verdict form to the jury, which just simply comes back, is the plaintiff entitled to recover, and if so, how much? And that's done quite frequently in smaller cases. In larger cases, you will submit special interrogatories to the jury, which may very well take into consideration percentages of fault particularly where you have multiple defendants. But under our present system, you could do that. But you are allowed under the present system, under our pleading and practice rules, to submit special interrogatories to the jury in a civil case.
That means that's basically a much...
On general verdict, you just ask the jury, if the plaintiff is entitled to recover, how much? And you can do that now.
Do both parties have to agree, or all parties?
No, not necessarily. Each party will submit the verdict form they're comfortable with, and the court will decide which one's going to go to the jury, if either.
Thank you, Bruce.
Mm-hmm. Representative Minutes.
Mr. Crew, I want to run a scenario by you, and correct me if I'm wrong. The situation you described, where you have a traffic accident, lady's looking in the back seat, and her child is choking or coughing or whatever, and she's subsequently involved in an accident with someone who runs a red light. If the lady is insured and the other driver is not insured, the one who's for them, oh, wait a second, am I doing this right? Let's reverse it. Let's say that the one party who has, never mind, disregard the question. I have to think this thing through. I'm trying to figure out whether or not this pure comparative negligence scenario would allow someone who wouldn't ordinarily have access to a lawsuit to recover damages from an insurance company could subsequently have access to someone's insurance if they were uninsured. I don't know if I've said that right or not, but it's my understanding that if you hit somebody who's insured and you're responsible for the accident, that you cannot sue the other person for the lesser part of contributive negligence. For instance, let's say I'm at fault, but I'm uninsured. I can't currently access the other person's insurance policy to recover portions of my damages, as I understand it.
Well, that's correct, because if you're more at fault under the current system, you would recover nothing in any event. Under the pure system, you could have access to it. That raises interesting questions that then the person who was injured, whether or not they would then have a claim back to recover the monies that you received. It'd become quite complex, really.
Well, I guess it is making a certain amount of sense. Let's say that I'm 51% or better responsible for the accident, but I'm uninsured. The other party, let's say, is 40%. Ever, or at least we assume they're 40% because of the nature of the accident. Does that allow me, who doesn't have the insurance, to go and sue the other driver who does have insurance to recover the 40% of their comparative negligence, which, under as I understand it now, they couldn't do?
Yes.
So we're opening a Pandora's box of insurance problems here.
You're not opening a box. In fact, you've hit the nail on the head, and that is that everyone in the accident is a potential plaintiff. To the last person is a potential plaintiff. Whereas now, if you're more at fault, you're not going to be a plaintiff, or better yet, you're not going to get a recovery.
Which means as a police officer, I get subpoenaed to civil trials more often than I do now, right?
Pardon?
I said as a police officer, I get subpoenaed to civil trials more often than I do.
You spend most of your time in the courthouse.
Okay.
Representative Max.
Thank you. First, I'll apologize in advance. I'm going to have to leave in 2 minutes for a much sought-after appointment at the governor's office. I'm not going to lose that time slot. But I understand we're not going past 5 o'clock, Mr. Chairman.
I have all night.
All right, well, I'll come back and see if everybody's here. What studies specifically have you been citing to us in regard to these statistics and this information?
The study that I was citing to you, and the reason I didn't tender it to you, if you will, for your review, is a Journal of American Insurance, first quarter, it's 1984. But I might add that there's another gentleman here, Mr. Kilmer, who's going to be testifying, and he is going to submit that study to you for your review, and hopefully you'll review it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions of Mr. Crew? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Clark, I believe you had a question of an earlier witness.
I have a question for Mr. Johnson, if you could come back up for a minute, please.
Mr. Johnson, if you could.
Chairman, Representative.
I'm looking back through your testimony here, and the desirable social end of making all parties responsible for their conduct. And I'm just thinking this thing through. and I'm not getting from point A to point B. I'm not getting from comparative negligence, pure comparative negligence, to making all parties responsible for their conduct. And let me tell you why and what I'm struggling with. You go back and forth, and you're still, regardless of one's opinion about whether juries can make distinctions of 52%, 48%, whatever, there's still a hunch that a jury's going to come up with as to what was the real cause of this action. Where does the blame really lie? Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm still not clear on the purpose for the bill. Why are we doing this? Why do you want us to do this?
Right. Well, two things. I think today you see a number of cases where the question on the 50-50 border is very close. If you look at the bill, you'll see that the original comparative negligence bill was adopted in Oregon in 1971, and there, if you were equally at fault, you lost. It was 50-50. 4 years later, in 75, it was amended to make it 51-49. So today, the claimant is entitled to recover unless he's more at fault than a plaintiff. Still, talking to a number of attorneys, as I have about this subject, they've reported to me many cases where it's still very close, like in the range of 40 to 60 or 55, 45 cases. But I agree with you, probably it'd be very difficult